Good evening. This is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us on Eco Radio. Tonight I have Dr. Diane Lewis, and she is going to be talking about healthy lawns and problems with chemical toxins. Dr. Lewis is the founder of the nonprofit organization, The Great Healthy Yard Project, and the author of the book by the same name. She is a nephrologist, a one-time organic farmer in the High Peaks region of the Adirondacks, the shortest growing season in New York, and an avid gardener. She is also a member of the Bedford Garden Board and the Audubon Women's in Conservation. She is a freelance reporter. Thank you, Dr. Lewis, for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
In your book, let me have you just start out. You talk about how you got into this issue, and you talk about the Hudson River and one of the events back when, I believe it said, when you were 12 years old. So can you give us some background on that, all of that?
Oh, well, yes. I talk about how when I was a child, I grew up not far from the Hudson River in the Bronx. And the Hudson was considered so dirty you weren't allowed anywhere near it. But that was sort of considered the price of progress. It wasn't necessarily a bad thing. It was just the way things were, surprisingly. And one day, I was with a girlfriend, and we climbed over the fence to explore what was beyond it, and there was a stone fence with a wrought iron fence on top of it. We got all the way over and found these beautiful old mansions overlooking the Hudson, and we peered in the windows of one, and that was the Glendore Mansion. And inside, instead of beautiful furniture and grand rooms, everything was whitewashed, and they had fish tanks and specimens from the Hudson River. And they caught us trespassing and put us to work. It was called Wave Hill Center for Environmental Studies. And my friend and I would go frequently and climb over the fence and find them, and they'd give us things to do. But we really learned that you could make it, everybody could make a difference, and you really could make a change. And the Hudson River has gotten so much cleaner that people swim in it and kayak in it now.
Okay. And you talk about, too, it was reference to the Wave Hill Center for Environmental Studies. What do they do?
They no longer exist. That was there when I was younger and I climbed over, and they really were at the forefront of getting people to believe that they could turn the river around and restore the ecological balance of the Hudson River. It had almost no fish and has fish now. Now it's a horticultural center, so it grows all different types of plants for people to see.
Okay, and you referred to the era of Silent Spring in the Love Canal and the DES. I know what Love Canal is. Can you tell us a little bit what Silent Spring is and what DES refers to?
Yes, Silent Spring is was a book by Rachel Carson, which was published in 1962, and she was the first one that let everybody know that birds were dying widely from the pesticides that were used liberally at that time, especially DDT. DDT caused eggshell thinning. And it was after that book was published that DDT was banned for widespread use. When DDT first went into use, it was actually considered to be a wonderful chemical because it helped prevent malaria. But then we learned that it caused all sorts of problems, and Rachel Carson was one of the first ones to make that connection.
Okay, and you referred to the DDT killing the birds. I recall within the last few years sometime I had seen where there was a massive bird die-off when birds were essentially falling out of the sky. Over, I think it was an area in Arkansas in some second place. Is that related to the same type of problems? Are there chemical concerns with those birds?
There are chemical concerns with birds. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says that 72 million birds die every year simply from pesticides. The Audubon Society, I'm a board member of Audubon New York, and the Audubon Society recently came out with a climate change project that showed that many, many species of birds are markedly diminished from where they were only a few decades ago, and that is because of a number of factors, including pesticides, but also including climate change, which makes food unavailable where it would normally be available at the right time of year for the migrating birds, or the wrong food available, in addition to the pesticides, and habitat destruction. You know, as we develop more and more areas, there's less and less native plants and habitat for those birds. So what's those bird die-offs were, I don't think they were necessarily directly related to pesticides. I honestly don't remember exactly what it is, but it's always a worry when you see a big die-off if there's been some sort of pesticide spraying, you know, agricultural spraying in an area. But there can be other things too.
Okay, and in your book, you indicate that chemicals used by consumers, including chemicals on the lawn outside, as well as drugs and household cleaning chemicals, are a larger problem for the water supply now than industrial chemicals. So can you tell us a little bit about that? And I know we hear about industrial spills, and we hear about oil spills, and we hear about companies actually dumping illegal chemicals into the rivers. But if I understand what you're saying in the book, you're saying that that's less than what we put into the water from our consumer chemicals. Is that right?
Yes. Well, after Love Canal, I don't know if everybody listening remembers Love Canal, but in the 1970s in upstate New York, they had built a residential community and school on top of what had been a toxic waste dump. And they had a large incidence of cancers and miscarriages and abnormal births in the community that settled there. So that was the beginning of the Superfund site, and it increased awareness throughout the country that these toxic wastes didn't disappear when we put them underground in large areas, that they were still a serious problem, and we had to dispose of things differently. So the Clean Water Act, was, as well as the Superfund Act, was somewhat a reaction to that. And in the 1970s, the Clean Water Act went into effect. And with that, there has been a steady decline in the number of industrial causes of pollution nationwide. When they occur, they're still horrific, and they're still a huge problem, and they do occur. But the most widespread source of pollution in our drinking water nationwide are the chemicals that we put on our lawns and gardens and the pharmaceuticals we pour down our drains to dispose. In 2013, the Environmental Protection Agency released a study showing that more than half of the water nationwide had enough fertilizer in it to be deemed a poor quality to support life, and up to 71% here where I live in the Northeast and also in the Midwest. And the U.S. Geologic Survey has tested water nationwide and released studies showing that at least one pesticide is found in almost every stream, lake, and river, and half of the deep groundwater wells nationwide. And often there's more than one. And while the amounts of these are very, very small, we now know that they act cumulatively. So they act together to cause problems.
Okay. And I'm not sure what you were referring to. In the book, it also says 95% of the acres of the yards are impacted by pesticides. So you're saying 95% of all household lawns have pesticides? And
No, 95% of water probably is what you're referring to.
Okay, all right.
54% of the land nationwide is residential. 41% is agricultural. And more land is being developed, so that keeps tipping in favor of residential. What we do in our yards and gardens matters a lot. It's not just farmers, it's us. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says that Americans use 10 times more chemicals per acre on their yards and gardens than farmers do on farm fields. What we do matters a lot. So this is a really, really big problem that has huge public health impacts that we're only learning about now. But it's such an easy problem to fix and make a huge difference on. We can have really, really beautiful lawns without using these chemicals. There is no need for us to be using them. In my article in the New York Times last May, I explained how the Environmental Protection Agency was planning on changing the regulations to protect farm workers that worked with the same chemicals that we use in our yards and gardens, because they know that these farm workers had an increased incidence of prostate cancer, lung cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and Parkinson's disease. We also know that these workers have an increased incidence of diabetes. Why would we use these chemicals just to chase what's really an outdated aesthetic of a uniform emerald green lawn? I think many people have changed their minds about what's attractive as they've learned more and feel that a more diverse lawn that's not quite so perfect with native plants in the gardens where you're not walking and playing are a wonderful, beautiful way to keep your yard, and it's beautiful way to entertain, a beautiful way to frame your house, and your yard and garden will be more alive with bees and butterflies and birds, and your children will be safe, and our drinking water will be safe.
Okay. Now, you talk about different water sources, and if you could tell us a little bit, distinguish what differences between groundwater and surface water and the aquifers?
Yes. I think many people, when they think of water, think of just turning on their taps, particularly in a city and in a suburb. But in fact, when it rains, water rushes down on our lawns and gardens and is either absorbed into the ground to join the aquifer and become groundwater, which is where people get well water from, or it runs off into our streams, lakes, and rivers, and there it becomes drinking water as well. Almost all of Kansas City gets its drinking water from the Missouri River, but the storm water in Kansas City runs either into the Kansas River or the Missouri River. So water treatment does not take all of these chemicals out. The only way to prevent them from being in our drinking water is to not put them there in the first place. But that's really, really easy to do. And bottled water isn't a solution because bottled water comes from the same rivers, streams, and lakes that our drinking water does. So the surface water is the water, when it rains, that runs off into these streams, lakes, and rivers and carries with it anything that's lying on the top of the ground, like these chemicals.
Okay. Now, so at some point, groundwater mixes with the surface water as well. Is that correct?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Underneath the groundwater is in contact with the water in a lake or a river.
All right. And you're saying that bottled water is not the solution. Does bottled water at least have some benefits in terms of less bacteria or less viruses in it?
Nope. Drinking water that is city drinking water is really thoroughly tested, much better than bottled water. And it is it will have to meet all of the many requirements. I think there are 90 things that are required to be tested in for the Clean Drinking Water Standard. This isn't true for bottled water. The tests are not as rigorous on bottled water. When you have your own house and your own with a well, it's your responsibility to test that well water.
Okay. Now, explain to us a little bit about how the fertilizers and the pesticides and herbicides, when they get into the groundwater, is there a way to get that out? Is there a natural purification process that occurs?
When groundwater tends to be cleaner than streams, lake, and river water, and that's why the government tests have found only half of the groundwater wells, compared with almost every stream, lake, and river, have pesticides in them. What happens to groundwater is the groundwater is absorbed by plant roots, and that some of the toxins are absorbed by the plant roots, and then it sits in the top layer of soil where soil bacteria break down many of the chemicals, and then it's filtered as it goes through sand and rocks hundreds of feet down. So there's a really, really good natural cleaning process for groundwater. And nonetheless, it doesn't get all of those chemicals out.
Okay.
So we really need to just not put them there.
And when we talk about the soil filtering out and the bacteria, is bacteria one of the ways that it, at water treatment plants in the cities, is bacteria used to purify water in those facilities?
Bacteria is one of the main ways we clean water, which I think many people don't realize. But when we, in water treatment, first we let things settle, and we can use chemicals like aluminum or other plastics that the particles can adhere to help separate things out. And that material all falls to the bottom. And the water then goes through a stream after it has settled. And that stream has liquid waste or if not waste, this is in a sewage treatment facility, it's waste. And the bacteria devour that and break it down. Usually for drinking water, and then after, I'm sorry, so the particles settle, it goes into the next area of a water treatment facility where bacteria break down the waste, and then usually there is ozonation. Ozone helps kill bacteria and parasites like Giardia or Cryptosporosis, which are a big problem in water supplies. They come naturally from raccoons and other animals that live near the water. It's in their excrement. And then some areas also chlorinate their water to help prevent bacteria. In drinking, that's for wastewater treatment. And then that treated waste winds up often going back into the rivers that are the same source of our drinking water, a little bit downriver, or someone else's drinking water downriver. Drinking water treatment varies tremendously from place to place, but it's similar in principle. Often it is filtration with sand, and ozonation or chlorination.
Okay, and when we talk about pesticides in your book, I think there were somewhere around four categories, I guess would be what I would say, of pesticides. Can you tell us what the different categories are and what the impact is on health and what's being done to keep those out of consumer products?
Well, I think it becomes difficult to just list to people what the different things are, and I think that sort of misses the point. The most commonly used pesticides are glyphosate, which disrupts our amino acids or proteins, and 2,4-D, which is a plant hormone, and carbaryl, which is a neurotoxin and is illegal in Denmark, Germany, and the UK, and malathione, which is an organophosphate chemical. But the thing that people are not going to sort through that. It's there in the book so people can look through it and understand each part of it if they want, more so that they have a working knowledge as they go forward. I think what people really need to take away is that these synthetic chemicals, pesticides, and fertilizers are all harmful, and we really don't need them. The way they harm us is through endocrine disruption. Some of them are also cancer-causing, but it wasn't until 2009 that the Endocrine Society, which is a group of doctors and researchers that specialize in how hormones affect our bodies, confirmed the link between chemicals such as these and diseases that are caused by disruption of the endocrine system. And this is not supposition anymore. This scientific statement put out by the Endocrine Society was based on 485 peer review papers. So what we now know is that chemicals that disrupt thyroid hormone, and when I say disrupt hormone, let me back up for 1 second. Hormones, when you think of hormones, what do you think of? Think of sex, puberty, but that's really not...
That would be some of
it,
yeah.
Yeah, but really, hormones control almost every function in our bodies. Everything from metabolism and growth to sexual development and neurologic development.
It controls diabetes too, doesn't it?
Yep, it absolutely does. And substances that interfere with either act like too much hormone or prevent normal hormone from acting, those substances that interfere with the hormones of metabolism can cause obesity and diabetes. They're not the only cause of these things, but we know they lead to an increased incidence. And in laboratory animals, when we put these substances into the blood of or mouths of laboratory animals, they will develop a higher incidence than other laboratory animals of obesity and diabetes. And as I mentioned before, that is parallel with the fact that farm workers that are exposed to these have a much higher incidence of diabetes. Chemicals that, including the pesticides that we use very regularly, interfere with thyroid hormone, interfere with regular brain and neurologic development. And this is particularly true for all endocrine disruptors if it's not the amount. So with carcinogens, if you're exposed to a large amount, you're more likely to get the disease, you're more likely to get cancer because your body can't fight it off and correct the damage to the DNA caused by the cancer-causing chemical. In endocrine disruptors, that's not true. A very, very, very tiny amount can cause the problem if you're exposed at the wrong time. So if a pregnant woman or a young child is exposed to a chemical that interferes with their thyroid hormone, their brain and their nervous system won't develop normally. And in fact, we know that in laboratory animals, we can increase the incidence of diminished learning capacity, and also things that are similar to ADHD and autism by interfering with thyroid hormone. We also know that we can interfere with the hormones of sex in laboratory animals and cause problems. And interfering with the hormones of sex can lead to increased breast cancer, prostate cancer, and infertility. And these, we now know that up to women that have been exposed to these chemicals since birth. So these chemicals largely came onto the market in World War II when they were considered an absolute godsend because they really helped us win the war by killing the mosquitoes that caused malaria, and because the fertilizers were able to give us an initial increase in production of food. It dropped off, but initially there was a big increase. So they were thought to be absolutely wonderful. But children born in the 70s are the first generation where their parents were exposed, and they were exposed from birth. And those people that are now adults are seeing 12% of women have breast cancer, 16% of men have prostate cancer, and by 2050, we expect 1 in 3 Americans to have diabetes, and neurodevelopmental problems have skyrocketed. Now, as I said, this is not the only cause of these problems, but we know that it leads to a statistical increase. And we don't need these chemicals on our lawns and gardens. This is a really, really wonderfully easy thing to fix. And we can have really much more beautiful gardens if we look towards native plants and natural turf care.
Okay, and you talk about native plants. What are native plants?
Native plants are plants that, by definition, were here before the settlers brought plants from Europe. So they're not only part of our horticultural heritage, but they support insects that have co-evolved with them. And those insects support amphibians, and they support, and by doing that, they support the entire food chain. They also support our birds and our butterflies. And our birds and butterflies are struggling from pesticides. But very importantly for the Great Healthy Yard Project, these native plants are not only beautiful, but they require very little care if they're put into the right area where they're native and where they belong. So swampy, marshy things can go in swamp areas, and there are native plants for dry areas and grassland prairies and woodlands. And then they don't need a lot of water once they've, you know, after the first year. They can survive droughts well. They can hold water, and they help nurture the soil, and they help nurture our pollinators. So if your garden, if you use these native plants, your garden just becomes alive with butterflies and birds. And echinacea is one of my favorite native plants. The goldfinches just love the little thistles in the center of the flower as it dries out. And the butterflies and the bees will crowd each other on the flowers because it's, you know, so good for them. And it's just beautiful. The whole garden is sort of buzzing and hopping, and there are dragonflies that are attracted to them, and the dragonflies eat lots and lots of mosquitoes. So it attracts all of your good insects that can help combat your bad insects. There are a couple of sources where people can find out more information about native plants for the Missouri area. One of them is the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center in Texas, and they're an affiliate of the Great Healthy Yard Project. They have an amazing database, which is really easy to use. They are at wildflower.org, and you can look for native Missouri trees, plants, shrubs, grasses, or flowers, and they have a question area where you can ask Mr. Smarty Pants specific questions. There are also local resources, including the Missouri Prairie Foundation, which is at grownative.org. And they have all sorts of information for both education and marketing for native plants. So they have a resource guide that has local design, service and maintenance, and plant sources. And the Kansas Native Plant Society is also a tremendous resource for both prairie and woodland plants, with education, information on how to plant, and information on public gardens.
Okay. Now, when you're talking about native plants, too, if you're planting a garden with native plants, is there a problem with getting the native plants to grow without them being crowded out by the invasive species that grow everywhere?
Invasive species are a huge problem. They're a very particularly big problem in woodlands where they can crowd out trees and prevent forest regeneration. And our trees are really important for filtering our drinking water. And also for absorbing our greenhouse gases. In our gardens, in our vegetable gardens and our flower beds, it's often much easier to control invasive species simply by manually weeding them. So, yes, you're absolutely right. Invasive species are a huge issue. But if you get your native plants to flourish and you put in the effort in the beginning as they're growing in, they will, in fact, crowd out most of the invasive species, and then you can weed them. Again, harder in an open woodland where you physically can't weed all of it and where you may have deer like we do here. The deer eat most of the native plants and ephemeral, spring ephemerals, and leave the barberry and other invasive species alone. So, yes, that does become a big problem. But much easier to manage, at least in garden beds.
Hey, and I believe we need to take a break, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Thank you very much.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
Imagine Midtown Kansas City with a vibrant cultural district with enhanced public spaces in neighborhoods and institutions. The Nelson Atkins Museum of Art is working to help develop such a plan and is inviting the community to take part in envisioning the possibilities. On this Wednesday's All Souls Forum, we'll hear Catherine Footer from the museum talking about this project. That's at 12 noon right here on KKFI.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Diane Lewis, and we're talking about Healthy Lawn Project and problems with contamination of our water and our lawns by pesticides and other chemicals. Welcome back, Diane.
Thank you.
In your book, you talk about quite a bit about septic tanks, and, of course, a lot of smaller communities have septic tanks rather than city supply. It seemed to me that when reading about the problems that you were maybe suggesting the septic tanks are worse than relying on city water. Is that correct?
Well, septic tanks are wastewater. So it's either wastewater either goes into a septic tank in a smaller community or a sewage treatment plant in a larger community. And a septic and a sewage treatment plant is really very similar to a very, very large septic tank. We went over that a little bit before. The bacteria do a lot of the work degrading the waste in both the septic tank and in the sewage treatment plant. Some of the advantages of a sewage treatment plant are that it can be more readily controlled. You can have a higher density of bacteria, and you can aerate them and keep them very, very active, so they degrade a lot of the waste. And then there can be more substantive filtering afterwards. But again, even the best treatment from either a septic system or a sewage treatment plant does not get all of these chemicals out. But it's so easy to not put these chemicals into the water supply. It's a really, really easy way to make a huge positive impact on our family's health, and it doesn't cost any time. It doesn't take any money. There's sort of a myth that it's more expensive to take care of your yard organically. And in fact, quite the opposite is true. While some of the organic fertilizers and supplements are more expensive than the synthetic ones, you use much smaller amounts much less frequently. And so it does not wind up costing more. In fact, it's money saving. So there is a state historic site that I'm involved with right near my house called John Jay Homestead. He was the first U.S. Supreme Court justice, and they have his old 62-acre farm. And 5 years ago, they stopped using all of these chemicals on the homestead grounds. And they did that to save money because New York State was struggling financially. They have, in fact, saved a lot of money, and the homestead looks even more beautiful. And they've done studies to show that they've had many more birds and more species of butterflies on the property since they did this.
Tell us a little bit, what is the difference between the herbicides, what they do, and what fertilizers do?
Herbicides kill plants. So some people use herbicides to kill dandelions or broad-leafed weeds in their lawns. In fact, a few dandelions are not a bad thing. It's much better to have healthy children on a lawn with a few dandelions than it is to have children running around on a chemically laden lawn that might actually hurt them. But when you see a lawn that's filled with dandelions, instead of thinking of an herbicide to kill that plant, you can think of relieving it of compaction by aerating it, core aerating it. So herbicides kill weeds. Pesticides kill bugs, but synthetic pesticides kill both bugs, good bugs and bad bugs. And it's our good bugs, both in the soil and on our, in the garden, that help protect us from the bad bugs. So dragonflies get killed by these chemicals too, by the pesticides. And dragonflies can eat up to 1,000 mosquitoes a day. We don't want to kill our dragonflies. Bees are suffering from colony collapse disorder, which is caused by many factors. One of them is pesticides. They think that mites and lack of native plants and weeds and traveling around from place to place on monocultures of corn and soy are another. But pesticides are one of the major factors contributing to that. So using synthetic pesticides kills all of our bugs. It also kills our soil bacteria. And the soil bacteria are needed to give nutrition to the plants. Soil bacteria can take nitrogen from the air and fix it into a different form where the plants can use the nitrogen. And they can also add carbon to the soil, preventing it from going into the air like a greenhouse gas. And plants need carbon to grow.
We just have a few seconds left.
And then the fertilizers are synthetic fertilizers are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium to help make the plants grow.
Diane, we only have a few seconds left. Can you just real quick? Okay. So we need to wrap that up, and we need to go to the calendar now with Natural E. and thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope people go to the website, thegreathealthyyardproject.com, and look at how we can work together to help protect our water. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'm Naturally, and I have your environmental events. Tomorrow, February 17th at 7 p.m., our very own Richard Mabian will give a presentation, Environmental Justice in Kansas City, including everyone in the movement. This takes place at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center tomorrow at 7 p.m. Seed Saving 101 will teach beginners how to save seeds from their gardens. This class will cover why seed saving is important, how to save seeds, and will include demonstration of different seed-saving methods. This workshop is hosted by Seed Savers KC, who has a seed library on site. This class will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. tomorrow at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center, which is located at 4750 Troost Avenue, and you can find out more information by visiting seedsavers-kc.org. Kansas environmental and sustainability groups will be crowding the state capitol to discuss a clean energy economy with our state leaders. Legislators will be available to speak to their constituents. Kansas wants a responsible energy plan to transition their state to clean, renewable energy like wind and solar and improvements in energy efficiency. Investments in a clean energy economy create and keep good jobs in communities across Kansas, save money for families and businesses in the long run, and improve our health and environment. Join them on Wednesday, February 25th at 9 a.m. And for more information, visit Kansans for Clean Energy on Facebook. And that's Kansans, the number 4, Clean Energy. And that's all for your events.
Mega droughts and blizzards for the week ending February 15th. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Residents of the Boston area are experiencing yet another blizzard this day after Valentine's Day, and the new storm dubbed Neptune has delivered about a foot of snow on top of the 6 feet that is already standing in some places.
While New Englanders attempt to deal with this latest storm, scientists released a new study showing that hurricanes in the area were much worse way back in the first millennia than those in the recent past.
The problem is that the more frequent and powerful hurricanes were likely due to warmer ocean temperatures. And the speculation is that the current climate warming could lead to something like a Category 3 storm every 10 years or so in the New England region, rather than every 100 to 200 years.
Jeff Donnelly, a scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts and lead author of the study, said in a press release that the prehistoric hurricanes would be catastrophic if they hit the region today.
The city of Denver, Colorado, is celebrating its conservation efforts as residents have cut water usage to the point where less water is now used than any time since 1973.
According to the Denver Post, these gains come while the population has increased by 350,000 new residents. Denver homeowners use 82 gallons a day per person for all indoor and outdoor purposes, down from 104 gallons in 2001. Denver is ahead of other major western cities.
Conservation measures are critical, as a new report came out last week that estimated the chance of a mega drought, one lasting longer than 35 years, as very high by 2100 if greenhouse gas emissions around the globe continue rising at current rates.
The report was published in the journal Science Advances and noted that these conditions would bring unprecedented drought conditions to the Southwest and Great Plains equal to the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. However, droughts would last much longer because of climate change.
None of these dire warnings will come as a surprise to people living in Utah. Saturday marked the 40th consecutive day that temperatures in Salt Lake City have been above average.
Mountain temperatures have been abnormally high as well. Overall, the conditions are more like that of early April than mid-February.
The high temperatures have an impact on soil. The ground can store an enormous amount of heat, and according to the Utah Snow Survey, soil temperatures have jumped 2 degrees over the last 2 weeks. So even if it does snow, with all that stored heat, the snow will melt.
The iconic Great Salt Lake is taking it on the chin, too. The water level is 18 feet below its level from 15 years ago.
High temperatures are accelerating evaporation. As the water level drops, the salinity of the lake intensifies. According to biologist Jamie Butler with the Great Salt Lake Institute, the salt content can change the entire food chain, affecting everything from the microbes living in the mud and water to the birds feeding at the lake.
Dropping water levels also impact lake effect snowfall.
So if there's less lake, then there's less lake effect, and ultimately less snow. A vicious cycle that residents there hope will soon be broken. Sao Paulo, Brazil's water crisis is getting worse. The city's 20 million people are facing possible water shutoffs for up to 5 days a week.
The city's main reservoir is not more than 6% full, and many small businesses may have to severely cut back services if not shut down completely. The crisis is having health effects. The number of dengue fever cases in Sao Paulo tripled in January from the previous year to 120. Officials blame the rise in part to residents collecting rainwater in open buckets, which attracts mosquitoes.
And the drought is having effects on the economy, as Brazil depends on hydroelectric dams for about three-quarters of its electricity. Relief does not appear imminent, as the rainy season does not usually start until October.
Finally today, if the grim news about mega droughts and more frequent and powerful hurricanes makes you want to curl up with a pint of Ben and Jerry's, we get it.
So speaking of comfort food, we wanted to bring your attention to a recent study about a favorite, popcorn.
It's already been known for some time that pressurized water vapor inside popcorn kernels causes them to burst. But a pair of French researchers wanted to get to the physics behind it.
Up until now, research on popcorn has been focused on practical questions like the optimum moisture content, 14% if you're curious, and the ideal shape for a kernel. It turns out that the best shape is a sphere, and knowing that has allowed plant breeders to reduce the rate of unpopped kernels by 75% since the 1950s.
For this recent research, the team used high-speed cameras to observe that as water turned to steam, it forced its way into the starch inside the kernel, causing something similar to cake batter to form. The pressure continues to build until the hull can no longer hold it, and boom, the kernel explodes.
The starchy batter cools just after it bursts, becoming a spongy white puff that we all know and love. The scientists assert their work could help students understand physical concepts like pressure, fracture, and elasticity, adding that it literally gives an appetite for science.
Indeed it does. As they ran each experiment, colleagues working in other parts of the building were drawn to their lab by that ever so distinctive microwave popcorn smell. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.